From WAMU 88.5 at American University in Washington, welcome to the Politics Hour, starring Tom Sherwood. He's broadcasting from home. I'm Kojo Namdi, also broadcasting from home. Tom Sherwood is our resident analyst and contributing writer for Washington City Paper. Tom Sherwood, welcome.
Hello, everyone.
Later in the broadcast, we'll be talking with Montgomery County Executive Mark Eldridge and Tommy Wells, who is representing the mayor of D.C., with the coordinating with the D.C. Board of Elections about upcoming elections. But first up is Ralph Northam. He is the governor of Virginia. Governor Northam, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Kojo and Tom, and appreciate all your listeners. This is a great way to get both accurate and updated information out, so I appreciate you having me on today.
Governor Northam, you've extended the stay-at-home order for Northern Virginia jurisdictions as well as for Richmond and Accomack County until May 29th. The rest of the Commonwealth begins reopening today. In your plan for reopening, you introduced five threshold metrics that should be met before transitioning to the first phase of reopening, including a downward trend of positive tests and hospitalizations for at least 14 days and increased testing and tracing. Has the rest of Virginia, outside of the places you granted with the stay-at-home extensions, met those requirements?
Absolutely, Kojo. And, looking at the percent positive rates in Virginia, we've had a downward trend actually for more than 14 days. Our PPE supply, I just commend everybody that's been working on this, is really good now. Our ability to test, we're approaching 10,000 tests a day, getting out into the communities more. Our hospital capacities are good. So I feel comfortable with those exceptions you mentioned, Kojo. Certainly Arlington, Prince William, Loudoun, Fairfax, and the city of Alexandria, the numbers are still high in Northern Virginia, as they are in the metropolitan area of Maryland and certainly the city of Washington, D.C. And so, in discussion with the leaders there, we just weren't comfortable moving into phase one. So we have extended the delay for 2 weeks.
The Virginia Black Caucus is not comfortable with your plan, sending you a letter strongly opposing it, emphasizing that a significant percentage of essential workers are people of color and that black and brown Virginians will become what they call guinea pigs for our economy under your reopening plan. How does your plan take into account the issues raised by the Black Caucus?
Kojo, I have a very close relationship with the Legislative Black Caucus, and I deeply appreciate their input, and I am absolutely to moving forward in a safe, gradual way that protects vulnerable Virginians, including our essential workers, our low-income individuals, and communities of color. So, we have recognized, not just during this pandemic, but the over our history, that we have significant inequities. The pandemic has certainly brought into focus the health care inequity, and we actually have a health care health equity task force that we've started. We're getting out into the communities. We were just handing out PPE a couple of days ago. I participated in that, doing more testing in communities. So I'm very sensitive to the inequities and want to do everything that I can to address that. And, as we move forward, Kojo, just want to do it in a safe and responsible manner. So I have a great relationship with the caucus, and I do appreciate their input.
Tom Sherwood.
Thank you, Governor. I have two questions. The first one, though, is about the testing. There's been something of a controversy about how the state was counting and reporting the various tests for the virus being done, that you were mingling diagnostic and antibodies without testing. Without getting into the weeds on that, you did, in fact, decide to change, as today, how you're reporting. What's the significance of that?
Yeah, that's a great question, Tom. And there are two basic tests, and I won't get into the weeds, especially as a doctor, but one is an antibody test that determines if you've had the virus in the past. The other is the antigen, or what we call the PCR. I realized actually this past weekend and Monday that that they were putting both of those tests together in looking at our numbers. I found that to be an issue. I told them that we needed to separate those two. I think what's important for people to know is that by separating them, it didn't change our curves at all. It would have not changed any of our policy decision making. But here's the issue, Tom. It wasn't intentional. They had been congregating these two tests from the beginning. I realized and recognized there was an issue. I own that, and I have fixed it. And that's what leaders do. And as we move forward, we'll continue to do both types of testing, but it is very important that we separate the two out, and that's what I intend to do.
Thank you very much. You kind of stayed out of the weeds there. Thank you. I have a lighter-hearted question. I was calling around in Richmond this morning, and I should ask you two things. That one, you still appear very neat on TV, so who's cutting your hair? You used to cut it yourself during the campaign. And secondly, I'm told you are getting out and maybe running some to stay healthy. People, are you wearing a mask?
Great questions, Tom. The first one, I did cut my own hair for about 15 years. When I ran for governor, my wife has a fairly large influence on me and said, you know what, it might be a good idea for you to let someone else do that. So I have allowed that. During this pandemic, my wife, actually, she's an occupational therapist and a teacher as well, but she's been taking care of my hair. I'm hopeful that if we can lift some of these restrictions, I will be able to get back to the barbershop. But and I have asked her, please, no more haircuts. So that's number one. The second running. Question, I do enjoy running. We have a new Labrador Retriever. Who I've enjoyed spending time with. My daughter, who is in her late 20s, lives in Richmond, and she came over and asked me to watch Tiger King with her one evening. I got through about 30 minutes of that and said, I can't take this anymore.
But yeah,
I have been enjoying The Last Dance, Michael Jordan's career, and
what about running?
I have really enjoyed that.
Are you running? Are you actually running, though?
I've heard
you.
Okay, good. That's a one-word answer. We don't have time for any more. Daniela Cheslow, our reporter at WMU, asks if you can provide specifics of how you will protect essential workers.
Yes, it's a great question. And I think the first thing to recognize is that they need to have PPE. And as you know, we have competed. When I say we, governors have competed for this. We finally have a good supply of PPE. So it's very important that our essential workers have that access. And also, Kojo, they need to have access to testing. If they don't feel well, or even if someone in their family, has symptoms, we need to make sure that they're tested and protect them and their family. So also, there are individuals that don't feel comfortable going back to work. We understand that. And so we have an adjudication process. We have an appeals process to let them enter that and make sure that when they feel comfortable going back to work, that's what will happen.
Here's Roxanne in Arlington, Virginia. Roxanne, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Great. Thank you. Governor Northam, thank you for everything that you've done so far for families in Virginia. I live in Arlington. My husband and I both work. We're both able to work from home. I have a 2-year-old son who normally goes to an in-home daycare. So he's not at a center. He's at an in-home daycare, but he's been home for about 9 weeks. I'm very lucky. My mother was able to move in with us and help take care of him, and we're just sort of patching things together and working at night. I realize I'm very lucky in this situation, but I'm just wondering what kind of guidance you're going to be providing and what we can expect in terms of in-home daycare, and then for other families, what about center, like more formalized center daycares? Thank you.
Roxanne, thanks so much for your question, and I hope you and your family are healthy and safe. Childcare is certainly something that is of utmost importance. Pam, my wife, has been working on this issue a lot. not only child care, but early childhood education. And so we are allowing our child care facilities to stay open. They maintain the social distancing as best they can. As you might imagine, with toddlers, that can be a challenge. The workers have access to PPE, the facial protection. And we just, this is good news, we just received a grant of $68 million that we're going to put to good use for child care throughout Virginia. So not only is this for essential workers, but those that are, you know, starting to go back to work as businesses open, the child care will be there for those families as well. So good things are happening in that area.
Tom Sherwood.
Governor, in April, the state took a hit of $700 million in revenues, and of course, it's closer to maybe $1 billion now. You have said you'll call the legislature back into session to adjust the state budget, the two-year budget. When will you do that? Have you set a date for that yet so people can pay attention?
No specific date, but Tom, to your point, you know, we have this past year one of the most progressive budgets that Virginia has ever had, a significant amount of investment, especially in education, higher education, our historically black colleges and universities, K through 12, early childhood education, and we've had to put all that on hold. I hit the pause button, and so your question is certainly relevant. We will do what we call a reforecast probably in July, and then once we know what our revenue is, and you just outlined that we do have a deficit of $700 million thus far, which is significant. But I will call the legislature back probably in early to mid-August to address our budget priorities. Yep. And one of those, Tom, just very quickly, is higher education. Obviously, our colleges and universities need to know where we are with state revenue so that they can plan for the fall.
We only have about a minute left, Governor, but I have to ask you about nursing homes. Most of Virginia's coronavirus deaths are linked to them. You said this week that you're committed to more testing at nursing homes. When and how can we expect that to happen?
Yes, we have about 260 nursing homes, long-term care facilities, and we are committed to testing all of our residents as well as the staff. I just had a great cooperation with the National Guard. The nursing homes also can contract through private labs such as Quest and LabCorp, and so part of the CARES Act is revenue that are resources that we can use to support our nursing homes. And I think the point that we need to understand, Kojo, is that, you know, if we test all of them today, 2 weeks from now, we may need to go back to nursing homes if they're, you know, are hot spots, et cetera. So this is a top priority. You mentioned this is our most vulnerable population, and we are committed to making sure that we can meet their needs to include PPE and the ability to test.
Ralph Northam is the governor of Virginia. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Kojo and Tom, and healthy to all of you, and have a great weekend.
When we come back, Tommy Wells up next. I'm Kojo Namdi. Welcome back. Joining us now is Tommy Wells. He is the director of the D.C. Department of Energy and Environment, but joins us today in his capacity as Mayor Muriel Bowser's representative with the D.C. Board of Elections to coordinate upcoming elections. Tommy Wells, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Kojo. I appreciate it.
And Tom, sure, we're talking about Mayor Muriel Bowser. She has extended the stay-at-home order through June 8th. She has tightened requirements on face coverages, and starting Monday, masks will be mandatory on all of Metro. Tom Sherwood.
Yes, well, the Metro decision was made by the Metro Board and the General Manager, Mr. Wiedefeld. The D.C. stay-at-home order was to have expired today. The mayor did extend it to June 8th. It was a little unclear what the mask rules are. Initially, it sounded like you had to wear a mask everywhere you went. There's been some clarification, and more will come from the mayor's office. But basically, if you're in any place where people are gathered, you should be wearing a mask. If you're in an office, in your office by yourself, that's different than being out in the office where other people are sitting. So that's the difference there.
Tommy Wells, D.C. is encouraging residents to request their absentee ballot for the upcoming June 2nd primary. How can residents do that?
Well, the first thing I want to say is that, you know, the mayor is very interested in being sure that everybody, you know, that this works and to support the Board of Elections. But I'm not, I want to be clear, I'm not speaking on behalf of the Board of Elections because, you know,
that's an independent agency, yes.
That's an independent agency. But the mayor wants everyone to know that we're providing all the support and help that we can to make this as easy as possible because this is a very different type of election. And BOE, the board, is very clear that they want people to vote by absentee ballot if possible. And they're getting the numbers up so that you don't even have to go down to vote. But and you need to get your ballot request in, your request for an absentee ballot, by May 26th, and that's by regulation. And so I do want to encourage anybody that's trying to do that and looking to do that, and the Board of Elections wants you to do that, go to dcboe.org, and it'll explain it all right there.
Well, I downloaded the app Vote for DC, and I can't seem to get past the date of birth. Every time I put in my date of birth, it keeps telling me that there's a web error there, but that's another story. Tom Sherwood.
Thank you, Mr. Wells. Thanks for joining us. Appreciate it. We've talked a couple of times about this. One question I keep hearing from people is, why, unlike Maryland, why didn't the district just simply mail out ballots to all the people registered to vote and then have the ballot, have them returned, rather than the three-step process of asking for a ballot, filling out the ballot, returning the ballot?
Well, that's a process that I think Maryland's been working on for a couple of years. You have to have a system set up to do that so that you have the verification on both ends. But, you know, again, on something like that, I think that you ought to have Michael Bennett or the Board of Elections in, but to answer that. But I will say that for this election, it's already different enough, and we want to assure that that it goes well. And so we're doing it by absentee ballot. And then early voting, which is very different this year, early voting starts May 22nd at the 20 sites that Board of Elections is using as polling sites all across the city. And you can vote at any one of those 20 sites starting on May 22nd. But otherwise, Tom, the answer is that the system is it takes a while to prepare a system like that.
Yes, there are going to be 20 vote sites instead of the 144 normally. So if you don't, and you don't have to go to the one in your ward, you can go wherever you want of those 20. But how will they know if I live here in Southwest Washington and I go to a site up in Northeast Washington, Turkey Thicket or something, how will they know? In fact, will they be able to check to make sure that I'm a registered voter in Southwest Washington?
Because everybody there will recognize you and say, that's Tom Sherwood. He doesn't live around here. But go ahead, please, Tommy Wells.
I'd be happy to live at Turkey Thicket.
They have a voter a way to use
IDs
a scanner.
Required?
IDs in DC you don't require.
I don't
IDs,
think so.
But yeah. But you can use they have a scanner bar. So really, you can't go to all 20 sites and vote 20 times. I mean, they know they've got a very good sound system to know when you voted. And so that you don't vote more than once.
Here is Linda in Washington, D.C. Linda, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi, Kojo. Thanks for taking my call. I'm a part of a group called We Vote Remote, and we're made up of members of the disability community. We've been following D.C. and Maryland's rules for voting remotely. My specific question is about what kind of assistance are you providing for people with disabilities who may have a hard time voting by mail in the primary?
Tom Sherwood? Tommy Wells?
We get confused all the time.
It's these Toms, yes.
Yes. For that, I think that you should call in down at Board of Elections to ask specifically, depending on what kind of assistance is needed. And that can be at 741-5283. Again, 202-741-5283. But I would call Board of Elections depending on the disability that they have. They do have accommodations, but I would talk to them directly.
Here is Marilyn in Washington, D.C. Marilyn, your turn.
Hi. I wanted to report my experience trying to get absentee ballots for my husband and myself. I did that on April 20th for both of us. We got confirmations from the Board of Elections to the effect that they did have our requests. And when on this Monday, May 11th, I still hadn't received a ballot, I called and was told that they had no record of my requests. They asked that I send back to them by email the copies of the confirmations they had sent me, which I promptly did. And the woman had said that when she gets them, she will email or call me to tell me she has them and she will send out the ballots. As of Wednesday, I still had heard nothing by email or phone, and I called.
Well, allow me to interrupt because we don't have a great deal of time, but Tommy Wells, have you heard other stories like this before, and what's the board likely to do about this?
Well, the board is really, they're working at breakneck speed. I have not heard of many issues like that, and I would encourage you to call again down there, but also to email them, and I know that they're listening to your show, as all good public officials do, and they will be aware when you contact them, Marilyn. So I'm sorry you've had that experience, but even though this is an unprecedented time, the Board of Elections is doing a good job. You should have what you need by now. Anybody that's made a request in April, there's not a huge backlog. They're getting this stuff out. So you should be able to get that, and I'm sorry you're having a tough time with that.
Tom Sherwood.
The voter's guide that's mailed out to all the registered voters also has an application people can use. But I want to go back to the ADA access of people who have disabilities. At those 20 sites, I would think that, Mr. Wells, maybe you know, that all 20 of the sites where you can vote in person beginning next Friday when early voting starts would be ADA accessible.
Board of Elections folks went and scoped them all out. There's 20 sites. Residents can vote at any one of those sites. They are
listed in the voter's guide.
They are listed in the voter's guide. Exactly right. And it starts May 22nd, 8:30 to 7. Every day except Memorial Day and the 25th will be closed. And then on the day of election, the polls will be open as normal, 7 to 8. But you can also, someone will come out to your car. If you need assistance with voting, you can pull up, like we've always had this, and they'll be ready. They'll come out to your car and they'll assist you with the voting.
Are you concerned, Tommy Wells, that these changes might impact voter turnout in major ways? Can you tell us how many absentee ballots have been requested so far?
Well, over 55,000, which is a historic high. They had about 100,000 people vote in total the last primary, which was 2016, and they only had 5,000 requests for absentee ballots. So it's moving pretty well, but I think it's tapered off a bit, and we need people to we strongly want them to vote by absentee, but all protections will be there. And practiced and observed by the poll workers, they'll be wearing masks. And the voters are expected to wear protective face covering as well.
And I'm afraid we're just about
turned away.
Out of time. Tommy Wells, thank you so much for joining us. When we come back, we'll be talking with Mark Elrich, Montgomery County Executive. I'm Kojo Namdi. Welcome back. Joining us now is Mark Elrich. He is the county executive for Montgomery County. Mark Elrich, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
If you have questions or I know Tom and I are. I'm hoping everybody is also well and safe, too. If you have questions or comments for Mark Elrich, the time to call is now. We don't have a great deal of time. You announced this week that Montgomery County will be remaining under a stay-at-home order, even though Governor Larry Hogan is beginning to reopen the state today. Why did you extend the order, and what metrics are you looking at to guide your own decision?
Well, you know, oddly enough, we were looking at the same metrics that we thought all of us agreed to. The CDC had issued a set of metrics, and the governor announced when he made his initial orders that we were following these metrics. And they, you know, involved a couple of key things, which was, you know, sustained reduction in cases in the state and sustained reduction in deaths and hospitalization rates over a 14-day period. And we haven't achieved that. We have the second highest number of cases in the state. We have the third highest rate of infections per 1,000 people. We are, you know, close neighbors with the District of Columbia and Prince George's County, both of which have also high rates of infection. And until we see the numbers come down, we don't want to do something that would rekindle the surge that had come about when this, you know, first hit the county. You know, if you look at the curves that a lot of people have had, those curves, they go up and then they start going up like a straight line. And we'd been able to get to the point where things, I would say, leveled off, but leveled off is not the same thing as decline. And our cases stayed, you know, relatively flat with some ups and downs and a few spikes, but they have not significantly declined in a while. In fact, over the last couple of weeks, we stay in a pretty, you know, I'd say a pretty narrow range. And the occasional spikes take it above that. So we need to get the cases down. And the reason, you know, that we're concerned in total is that our hospitals aren't full yet. But if we were to get a spike in cases, if we were to start running up on the curve that we started with, we could very easily exhaust our hospital space. And so it's very important that we be able to bring these metrics down. So we sent over to the council today a list of metrics, and you know, they do what it involves is a sustained decrease in the rolling average during a 14-day period of new cases, of increased testing. We need COVID-19 related hospital rates to come down. We need the ICU rate to come down. We need the fatalities to come down. You know, we were originally targeting, I forget whether it was 3 per day or 5 per day is a good sign. We're still generally up around 11 or 12 a day. We need the other illnesses that that seem to be similar to COVID. We need that number to go down.
Are these the reasons why you have not indicated an end date for the stay-at-home order in Montgomery County, as the Prince George's County Executive Angela Alsobrooks has done? Hers is June 1st. You haven't set a date.
Well, I suspect that everybody will revisit the dates, much as the governor, if you remember. You know, he said, you know, the schools were going to open, and then he had another date for opening, had another date for opening, and every time they got close to the date, they looked at the data and said the data is not there. I was reluctant to set a date, not because I don't think we'll reopen, but because if I set a date and the data doesn't support reopening, people are immediately going to say, you said you were going to open, say, on, you know, June 4th, and pick a date between D.C. and Prince George's County. And now you're saying you're not going to open. And so you lied to us and you misled us. And, you know, what we've been saying all along is, well, we will open when it's safe. We're not talking about zero, but when we think it's controllable and we have a handle on this.
Allow me to interrupt because we are running short on time already. Here's Tom Sherwood.
Thank you, Mr. Elridge. Two quick things. One, I got a message from someone asking that you allow the funeral homes in the county to have funerals, that they can do them safely, have social distancing. But as much as people are dying and hospitals are preparing for sick people, the funeral homes are kind of left out of this. And then secondly, just before we went on the air, Scott McFarlane of NBC4 showed some video from their helicopter of a very long food line up in Gaithersburg at the Boer Park there that Catholic Charities is doing. And the question is, in one of the wealthiest counties in the country, should more be done to provide food for people who are in need and not depend on, say, just Catholic Charities and these long lines that we're seeing on TV? Funerals and food.
So let's see. I'll do the food first. I mean, we're not relying on them. We're providing millions of dollars to nonprofits in order to get food and to support their activities. And we're going to continue to provide money directly to nonprofits in order to carry out these activities. I think I read today that another $1.2 million either went out today or went out yesterday to support these activities. So we're continuing to put money out for food. We're putting it out for rent. We're doing everything we can do to support that. And we'll continue to do it. We don't have a point where we said, okay, we've given all we're going to give. We have substantial money from the federal government, and you know that money has to last till December 30th, unless Congress comes back and gives us more money. But funerals. As long as we have that money, we're funerals. I've been to funerals. The ones I've been to, not recently, but anyone I've ever been to, I didn't see any sign of what would pass for safe social distancing if you're going to have a large number of people in some of those rooms. That gets really difficult to manage. It's something that we can talk about, and if people can demonstrate that they have plans that look like they would pass for being safe, we can certainly look at them. The executive order I sent over today allows us to make changes with the council's approval, and so we're going to be looking at the new CDC guidelines, which I guess were amended by the Trump administration, but we're going to see what we can glean from them. And we're going to look at something the governor referenced in his talk about this pledge, which he didn't make mandatory. He just urged businesses to abide by the pledge. Well, we're going to look at the pledge and see whether, if we actually require businesses to meet the pledge, do we get a higher level of certainty that the places will be safe. I just want to remind people, when people looked at what happened in Chicago and the explosion of cases there, they traced it to two social events. And so if these aren't done right, it is very possible for this to just reignite in the county.
Here's Beverly in Gaithersburg, Maryland. Beverly, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi. Thanks, Kojo. Love your show. Appreciate the support. And great news. I wanted to know, as a Montgomery County resident, where can we find information on what's allowed, what's not allowed, since we're making decisions different from what the governor has allowed?
Well, I mean, the good news is we're not making a lot of decisions that are different. I mean, the governor kept the limit on 10 people gathering. He kept the requirement on face masks. So he's not allowing congregation. What he did is he opened businesses at 50% capacity. We're not doing that. He allows churches to do services at 50% capacity. We are not doing that.
But where can Beverly find information about that?
So that's going to be on the county website, and I can go there. It's just montgomerycountymd.gov. And if you go there, the first thing you get presented with is this big blue box that says COVID-19, and you can click on that, and it'll take you to a page where all that information is available.
Okay, Beverly, thank you for your call. Dr. Travis Gales, the Montgomery County Health Officer, says that about 3% of Montgomery County residents have been tested for COVID-19. He'd like to get to 5% per month. What do you need in terms of resources to get to that level of testing?
So the good news is that we've identified two partners in our life sciences sector who will have the capacity to do tests at this volume. We have signed a contract with one. We're signing a contract with the other. And the second contract, I think we are going to be doing 20,000 tests a week. So to put that in perspective, I've got a little over a million people. 5% would be 50,000 tests. Once this thing is up and running, we will be doing 20,000 a week. So we will surpass that, and we fully intend to keep going, because 5% is kind of a minimal standard. It is not where we need to be. The goal is that every time we do a contact trace, you know, the old rule was tell people to shelter in place if they contacted somebody, not because that was best practice, but because there weren't test kits. Now when we do contact tracing, we're going to be able to get people tested. When we find a positive test in that contact line, we'll be able to take their contact and we'll be able to follow these things out. We have not been able to do that before. We will be able to do that now. That's a big deal. So I think we'll get that 5% pretty easily.
Tom Sherwood.
Mr. Elwert, you have several big unions in Montgomery County. You negotiated raises with them. but then the council rejected them as too much. And now the council has voted this week 7-2 to eliminate all the union raises. Is this something that's just simply a delay, or have they in fact been eliminated and you have to start all over? Let me just ask, how tough is the budget battle for you now?
Well, the budget battle is basically over. The council will pass the budget today, and it'll be done. My view was that, you know, when we negotiated the raises, it was a totally different climate. I believe we were in the largest expansion in history. And the day I submitted the budget, the world fell apart. So this was, you know, there, all the planning and everything and all the negotiating had been done earlier. The council initially rejected the budgets. We went back to the unions. They were willing to give up their COLAs, but they wanted to keep their steps. We did an analysis. The steps don't actually cost the county money because basically everybody moves up a step every year. This is the same thing in the federal government. One person replaces another person on the step. People come in at the bottom. People go off at the top. And when our analysts did a study of the difference in the county payroll from one year to the next, it wasn't the steps that increased the county payroll. It was the general wage adjustments or COLAs. So the unions gave up the general wage adjustments and COLAs and just wanted their members to be able to go up the steps. The council said no.
The council has eliminated all that. So they're dead. Is that right? They're dead?
They're dead. I thought it was unnecessary. Some council members, I haven't seen the final language. They're still working. You know, they're still finishing their budget. Their council members have said we can revisit this in the fall. Certainly, if the federal government replaces our lost revenues, we're in a different situation than we are now. And hopefully the Congress will come together and replace the lost revenues of jurisdictions like ours. Otherwise, you're going to just have a national catastrophe of everybody shrinking, and government will now contribute to the shrinking, which means less buying power, compounded with the shrinking in the private sector. This is not going to be good for the economy.
What are you anticipating in terms of revenue shortfall?
Well, we've got to reevaluate it because the state numbers this morning, I don't know if you followed where the state was, but in April they said that they anticipated a loss of $2.8 billion this year. They've reduced it to between, I think, $900 million and $1.1 billion, so they've drastically reduced their losses. They said that actually withholding had actually ticked up, which surprised everybody. But I've been trying to point out to people that with the new unemployment rules and the additional $600 checks, people are getting real unemployment. You know, an average check will be about $1,000 a week in Maryland. And that with the withholdings from that money, I mean, from that income are required, and they withhold it, either they pay it at the end or they withhold it now. So I wasn't surprised that things didn't dip as bad as they did during the recession, which is what people had were basing their assumptions on, because the recession didn't boost unemployment checks. This crisis has boosted unemployment checks. So we're still, the state's still down $1 billion, is nothing to sneeze at. And then next year, depending how fast we can recover, we'll have a better picture of what we're losing. But the county's, you know, anticipated to lose somewhere around $151 million. I'm going to assume that that number will be revised by the state based on this new data. We'll wait to see.
Here's Brett in Hagerstown. Brett, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hey, Kojo. Thanks for having me. I was just wondering if anyone there had an update on the state emergency business loans, the program that they launched in late March. I applied, I think, the day that they announced it. And as of today, it's almost been 2 months and it still says in process. I didn't know if any of those dollars have been issued. We've gotten the PPP money in and I applied for the EIDL loan as well. But as a small business owner, I haven't heard anything out of the state yet.
Mark Elrich, you know?
Yeah, I thought that some checks had been issued, but I also read that there's still a backlog and that, you know, they had closed themselves to applications and there's probably not enough money to deal with all the applications. So I don't know whether you've been rejected based on what you told me or whether the state is still has you in their processing line. There was a story about that. I didn't have a chance to read it fully this morning, but it's a continuing issue with the speed at which they get things out. And, you know, we set up a program and it's gone out slower than we want because none of us were set out set up to create criteria and then send out a bunch of money in a short period of time, because that's something we'd never had to do before. The states had the same problem, same with unemployment.
Dr. Travis Gale said that the county is creating an advisory panel of local experts to help the county reopen effectively. What can you tell us about that panel? Will you be relying on that panel?
Well, I think he's going to be looking to that panel for additional guidance. I mean, we're trying to put the best brains we can find, looking at our health data and helping us determine what the consequences would be of different decisions. I mean, that's ultimately what this is all about. If I reopen tomorrow, I'm pretty sure that would be a totally wrong decision, given our caseloads. But we need to understand, you know, what happens with lower caseloads and what happens with higher levels of protection. I mean, if I could be certain of certain protective measures being taken and aggressively enforced, that's different than where we are right now. Like I said, the governor asked people to follow this pledge, which requires people to do certain things in the workplace, but he didn't require them to follow the pledge. And so we're going to look at what's in the pledge to see what happens if you require people to follow it. Does that give us a higher level of certainty that people would be safe to return to work?
Tom Sherwood?
Mr. Elrich, there was some discussion beyond your advisory panel. There was some discussion that the Big Eight, Montgomery County, Prince George's, and the other big jurisdictions in the state might actually form together a pact to coordinate how they're going to respond in these more dense neighborhoods of the state of Maryland. Is that going to happen? How closely are you coordinating with other big jurisdictions like Montgomery County, at leaving out the district for this question?
I think we've talked every day this week, and, you know, we'd been on weekly calls for a long time. Then we were doing it 3 days a week, but we've talked, I think, pretty much every day this week. None of us are embracing the governor's full opening. I think that's clear.
Are you creating a pact among the Big Eight in the state of Maryland to address what the governor's not doing?
We are talking about that. We have another call today, and we're discussing, you know, how we deal with that. I mean, I think everybody's frustrated about talking about testing, and then many jurisdictions haven't seen any test kits, or, you know, saying that, you know, things are working when they don't appear to be working. So, you know, we're concerned, and, you know, Angela was very, you know, blunt about not getting the things that the state says are just have been available. One reason we went off on our own testing track here, and I've shared the information with the other county executives, is instead of waiting for tests to arrive, we decided we had to go find tests on our own. And we had experiences similar to the governor. We didn't buy the stuff, but we had opportunities to buy things, but everything was incomplete.
But politically, it sounds like you're not in this all together, that there are some fraying at the edges of what's being done in Maryland.
No, I don't think it's a matter of being not all together. There are different conditions in different counties. I mean, Angela and I have, you know, 50% of the cases in the state. If you add Baltimore and Baltimore County, we have 72% of the cases in the state. So the conditions are different in different counties. Stuart Pittman in Anne Arundel has slightly different conditions. Johnny O up in Baltimore County has slightly different conditions. But some of us that share common borders with other highly densely populated areas that also right now have very high case rates, we're in a little bit different place. So we've all agreed generally to not fully do what the governor said, but to allow each jurisdiction to map a path that makes sense based on their health data.
Here's Susan in Silver Spring. Susan, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Yes, good afternoon. I wanted to talk about nursing homes very briefly, the tragedy that is occurring there. There was a long article in the Post last week that mentioned that Montgomery County health officials said they've been in contact with the all 34 nursing homes, but haven't conducted any in-person compliance visits. Then one of the administrators at the Department of Health and Human Services said, when asked how the county is ensuring that facilities are abiding by regulations, he mentioned that the state had sent some inspectors. Well, first of all, he said, at this point, we're taking their word for it. And then it goes on to say, state inspectors were declined entry to several nursing homes. So my question is, how can we ensure the safety of residents in nursing homes, and how can we even allow it that inspectors be turned away from performing their legally mandated functions?
Okay, Mark Elrich. We have to stop at number one because we don't have a great deal of time. Mark Elrich.
Yeah, so the state is the agency that is responsible for regulating nursing homes. And we have stepped in. We created a strike team before. I hate that word, but whatever you want to call it. We created a force of people to work with the nursing homes. We've provided them with equipment. The governor has, I think, established stricter standards. The nursing homes were like everything else in the state, where the original guidance was, look for people who traveled to certain foreign countries. Huge mistake in guidance. It allowed cases to go undetected. And this is the most vulnerable population. But I also try to remind people, the nursing homes are the canary in the coal mine. It shows what happens when asymptomatic people, people without symptoms, circulate in the population, come in close contact with other people who don't have the virus, and how the transmission happens. Now, the impact is worse in a nursing home because these people have, you know, pre-existing conditions, but it's kind of a canary in the coal mine for everybody else, and people need to think about that. These cases didn't start in nursing homes. These cases were brought into nursing homes. But we are still working with them. The state is upping its testing protocol. We are going to be cooperating with them on testing both of the workforce in the nursing homes and the patients in the nursing homes. And one thing that has to happen with the workforce, it can't be tested once a week or even once a month. They need more frequent testing. I could test you today. You could go home or you could take a walk in your neighborhood, come in contact with somebody, get too close, catch a virus. And just because you were non-symptomatic, or just because you didn't have the virus today, doesn't mean you don't get it tomorrow. So we are working on strengthening that.
I'm sure we only have about 30 seconds left.
Are you, is that exercise equipment in your home still getting dust, gathering dust, as you said during your campaign? Are you getting any exercise?
No, it is not. I am on my elliptical. I want to say that I have dropped an amazing amount of weight and have my blood sugar totally in order. And I did that before this broke, and I'm really glad I did that because my health is much better than it was. I have my weight under control and a new diet to go with it.
Unfortunately, I won't be running into you in the supermarket anytime soon to validate that claim that you're making. But Mark,
you can run into me in the meat section because I'm protein crazy right now.
Mark Elrich, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Mark Elrich is the county executive for Montgomery County. Today's show was produced by Sydney Grant, and join me next Tuesday evening for a virtual town hall on navigating the post-pandemic job market. Whether you're a new graduate, recently unemployed, or someone who has been on the job hunt for a while, we'll dig into what you can do to be competitive in this new employment landscape and get hired. It's a free virtual event, but you do have to register to get the Zoom webinar link. You can find all of the details at kojoshow.org. And coming up on Monday, what are contact tracers doing to stop the spread of coronavirus? And he's too young to drive or vote, but he's not too young to make a prize-winning veal salt in Boca with spring pea ragout. Master Chef Junior Chase Piotta joins us on the latest Kojo for Kids segments. That all starts at noon on Monday. Until then, Tom Sherwood, what will you be doing?
I'll be social distancing from my refrigerator.
Tom Sherwood is our resident analyst and a contributing writer for Washington City Paper. Until Monday at noon, you have a wonderful weekend and stay safe. I'm Kojo Nandi.
The Kojo Nandi Show is produced by Julie Deppenbrock, Sydney Grannon, Lauren Marco, Kurt Gardner, Richard Cunningham, and Kayla Hewitt. Our managing producer is Mana Kashvi. Our engineer is Mike Kidd. For past shows and more content, visit kojoshow.org.